From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As early as next month, the FDA is expected to approve the injectable anti-wrinkle drug Botox for cosmetic use. Millions of Americans are way ahead of the FDA and already getting doctors to shoot them up with the paralyzing neurotoxin to eliminate those pesky laugh lines and furrowed brows. In this hour, holding up the mirror to America's obsession with looking young, whatever happened to aging gracefully? We begin tonight's discussion with an insider's look at how Botox will be marketed to the public. Greg Gilbert is a specialty pharmaceutical analyst at Merrill Lynch. Earlier, I asked him what FDA approval means for the American consumer.
What that will mean is that Allergan is the company that makes Botox. Allergan will be able to promote the use of Botox for cosmetic use to physicians and to potential users for the first time.
The use is already booming. What difference do you think it will make that the marketing comes on stream?
Well, I think the use right now isn't necessarily booming unless you're looking at a very specific user group, and that is around major metropolitan areas, New York, L.A., Miami, certain other major cities.
So in spite of the popularity in those areas, you see much more potential?
Right. Later in 2002, everyone in America will know what Botox is and what it can do for them.
How are people using Botox cosmetically today? How widely, and what's the growth potential?
Well, right now, Allergan estimates that substantially less than 10% of the target audience in terms of the patient base is using the drug today. Right now, physicians are able to purchase Botox from Allergan, but Allergan is not allowed to promote the usage for cosmetic use to doctors or to patients.
How does the company define its target user group?
The company has conducted a lot of market research looking primarily at women between 35 and 65 with a household income over $50,000 per year. That boils down to about 30 million American women. If you put that through a bunch of other criteria, in other words, women that are willing and able to pay for that and put themselves through injections or have the doctor do injections with a needle, it boils down to about 5.5 million women in America that fit that criteria. We estimate that that would be $2.5 to $3 billion in sales potential for Allergan.
What are the sales currently?
Currently, sales for Botox, in 2001, they sold about $310 million, and that's worldwide for all uses. Cosmetic use is less than one-third of that number currently.
So it's a big, big market. How does it compare to Viagra or Claritin?
Viagra and Claritin, you know, have much more of a mass market appeal. Botox is not for everybody. It will cost several hundred dollars several times per year to the patient, and it's not for a medical problem in the case of cosmetics. So it would be an out-of-pocket expenditure for the individual.
Now, Botox is a neurotoxin. It paralyzes the muscles in the face when it's used cosmetically or for whatever purpose.
Right.
Is Allergan the company that developed it? Is it a company that specializes in toxins or
Allergan
in
purchased the technology, I believe, in 1991 from a physician who had discovered that it could be used for certain ophthalmology indications, including cross-eyedness, which is called strabismus, mm-hmm. or blepharospasm, which is an abnormal contraction of the eyelid muscles. Allergan historically has been an ophthalmology company. That's what got them interested in Botox originally. It was by accident that an ophthalmologist discovered that it actually helped someone's brow furrow.
How did it move from being used for crossed eyes and so on to into the cosmetic market?
Sometime in the late 80s, doctors started to discover that it could be useful. It was actually, I believe, a husband and wife team, the husband being an ophthalmologist and the wife being a dermatologist, who discovered its use and started to use it in practice and built the business that way. From that time on, it just spread via word of mouth.
Is it unusual for a treatment like Botox to spread so widely simply by word of mouth without real mass marketing?
No, I think it's a real testament to the fact that the drug is very effective for what it's intended for. Americans spend millions or billions of dollars on lotions and creams and other remedies to help appearance that are not necessarily effective. So Botox is very effective, and the results show that.
Have you seen any resistance in the market because it is the injection of a paralyzing toxin into the face? It doesn't sound nice, even if the outcome is good. Does that give people pause before they use it?
Yes, I believe so. But again, that 5.5 million women target audience in the U.S. asks people the question of the injections and the affordability of the product. So I think one needs to consider it in context, that it is an injection, but there's plenty of upside in sales potential for Botox compared to where it is currently. That's what's exciting for Allergan.
It must be. So with 6 degrees for separation, a year or two from now, you're expecting almost everybody will know someone who's using Botox in their face.
Right, and if they know someone now, they might know two people in the future. So that would be a tremendous growth potential the way we see it.
Do you see a changing attitude among Americans toward aging that raises their interest in this, or is this just a constant and steady desire not to have wrinkles, to look young?
I think it's a constant and steady thing. It's just that awareness will change dramatically over the next 12 to 18 months as Allergan can help for the first time advertise to physicians and to patients. And I'm sure the media will have fun with this as well and make people even more aware.
Speaking of fun, have you heard stories about its use?
The most interesting anecdote I've heard is that some professional gamblers in Vegas use the product and able to hide all expression. Certainly not a large market, but an interesting one.
So put so much Botox in the muscles of your face that no expression is going to flash across the craps table.
The drug can certainly do that. I'm not sure actors would like to do that.
but it may be a poker player's dream.
Exactly.
Greg Gilbert is a specialty pharmaceutical analyst at Merrill Lynch. He spoke to us from New York. The old adage says wisdom comes with age, but is it wise to show your age anymore? The job market is tighter, the dating scene more competitive, and the pressure is greater than ever to put your best face forward. So let's Botox. But is the hugely popular toxic shot doing more than just numb faces and paralyze wrinkles? Is there such a thing as aging gracefully, naturally anymore? Or is it time to forget all that, grab the syringe, and join the Botox bandwagon? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Jeffrey Dover. He's professor of dermatology at Dartmouth Medical School and director of Skin Care Physicians of Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Dover.
Tom, thank you.
Jeffrey Dover, you have assuredly, given the enormous popularity of Botox, you've administered it.
I have.
You must also have some understanding from your conversations with people before and after of why they come and how they feel about it once they've done it. And I know you've written about human self-perception, about notions of beauty and aging and all that as well. Botox is now the most popular cosmetic medical procedure in the country. I think its use went up 1,600% between 97 and 2000. What's going on here? What is it about this particular treatment that makes it such catnip for folks who are looking at the wrinkles in the mirror?
It used to be that when one talked about cosmetic surgery, the only thing on the plate was a facelift. That scared away a lot of comers.
That means the scalpel.
Cutting, tugging, mm-hmm. bruising, 2 weeks out of work or more, mm-hmm. hospital stay, mm-hmm. anesthesia. It was very scary. In the last 10 years, lots of new developments have come to the fore in the area of cosmetic surgery. One of them is Botox. And what makes Botox so special is that it's simple, it's very elegant, it barely hurts, it takes about 10 minutes or 15 minutes to do. About 5 to 7 days later, the effects are shown, and people look much better for about 4 months. It's not covered, it's an out-of-pocket expense, but women look at their neighbors and say, "She looks terrific. What's she done?" And they ask, and sometimes the neighbor tells them.
And one can only imagine then how the domino effect sets in. My goodness, what are we getting into? Now, it is an incredibly poisonous neurotoxin that is at the heart of this treatment. Is that right?
That's correct. And in fact, in your introduction, you talked about people being scared about injecting poison into their body. And in fact, early on, we had lots of patients who came in and said, "Gee, I'd love to do this, but I'm scared to death. I don't want you injecting poison into me.
Well, Botox is a takeoff on botulism, one of the most deadly neurotoxins.
Right. And in fact, Botox is such a clever name because it sounds nice and clean and it doesn't make people think of poison.
But it is very, very diluted poison.
Yes, it's extraordinarily diluted. You'd have to actually inject 10,000 times the dose we use to cause somebody trouble. Mm-hmm. So it works so precisely, and if it's used in this dilute fashion, it's extraordinarily safe.
So, all right, 10 minutes of, I don't know, whatever, $300 or $1,000, depending, I don't know, and you walk out, and a few days later, the wrinkles are gone. They come back, though.
It lasts about 3 to 4 months, and it only works for what we call dynamic wrinkles. So the best one is the frown between the brows, or the
sort of vertical crease
exactly,
between the eyebrows.
It makes people look mad when they're happy,
right,
or mad when they're mad. The horizontal lines of the forehead, which make people either look surprised or much older than they are,
right,
and the crow's feet at the sides of the eyes. Those are the three favorite areas to inject because those are muscular folds or creases. And if we weaken the muscles that cause these, we can actually soften these folds and make people look more relaxed, a bit happier. And it actually makes people feel better about themselves.
Well, we're going to talk about all that, but I want to understand this context. The FDA has now approved it, or is about to approve it, I guess, for cosmetic use. But yet lots of people have already done it, more than a million people in the year 2000 alone. What's been going on in advance of FDA approval?
Well, the drug is approved to use for some of these spastic problems. For example, people who have an eyebrow or eyelid that's always twitching, mm-hmm. we inject Botox into that. It relaxes
calms
those
it
muscles
down.
And they stop twitching.
Mm-hmm.
It's approved for that. It's approved for neck spasm.
Mm-hmm.
When a drug is approved, a physician can use it in a contract with their patient, as long as the mm-hmm. patient and the physician agree to use it.
So it's grown up as a kind of a giant cottage industry outside the FDA
right,
approval.
It's what's called an off-label use. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of drugs in mm-hmm. America that are used for indications other than what the FDA approves. It's not illegal to use it, as long as the patient realizes that it's not FDA approved for that use.
And we heard our friend Glenn Gilbert talking earlier about once the FDA approval comes on stream, then they can advertise this the same way we've seen Viagra and Claritin and all these. They can advertise it heavily, which he says every American will know what Botox is soon.
Right. And he pointed out that it's a small segment which talks about it at cocktail parties. These are relatively well-to-do, usually women mm-hmm. between the ages of 30 and 60. But soon it'll be everybody will be hearing about it because it will be in their face, TV, print, radio.
Okay, so here we go. We're going into the nation of unlined faces, or at least an economic section of that nation with unlined faces. Terrific story in the New York Times about this week, and there's this great comment that says, it is now rare in certain social enclaves to see a woman over the age of 35 with the ability to look angry. What are we giving up for all this smoothed face wonderment? There's some kind of loss of expression in some degree. And beyond that, what about walking away from the kind of natural, you know, lines and grooves and splendor of aging?
We talk about aging gracefully. And, you know, it's nice if your parents age gracefully. If you've got parents in their 70s or 80s that look terrific, you'll look terrific when you're aging as well. But the truth is, most people don't age gracefully. And there's nothing wrong with doing a little bit to enhance your appearance. Women and men do their hair. They wear nice clothes. There's nothing wrong with doing something, a little something, to make your face look its best. But keep in mind, these are very modest improvements. And people still can frown, and they still can show expression. It's the rare individual who has too much Botox, who has a paralytic face, who can't frown at all.
But we read now about Hollywood directors having a heck of a time because so many actresses' faces are practically just totally paralyzed.
I love that part of the story. And in fact, if you watch the nightly news in America, you will see some of the anchors who have trouble raising their eyebrows, and they've had too much Botox, as far as I can see.
Well, is there a Botox addiction syndrome here? You get a little and you want it smoother, you get some more, you get some more pretty soon. Is it only TV and Hollywood folks who get into this, or do you see ordinary men and women with faces just Botoxed into paralysis overall?
In truth, most of our patients are just middle-class, delightful people who just want to look a little bit better. And most of them don't get crazed by this. But we have a few patients who call up and say, I see one frown line and I'm not supposed to have any. I'm coming in today and I want you to get rid of it. I have a party this weekend. I've got to look my best. I don't want anybody to know I have stress in my life. And that's the odd individual. But most patients, in fact, look better, but they're not totally wrinkle-free after this procedure.
Well, and yet we do have stress in our life. You've written about the modern compulsion for physical perfection and talking about how the visual media and the ease of travel both promote this. What do you mean?
Well, we're incessantly bombarded with images of perfect-looking individuals, especially mm-hmm. women. You look at any women's magazine and you see these half-clad women who look just better than anybody you've ever seen. And so a lot of young women want to look like these women, and so they'll go to almost any extreme to try and look like their idol.
And once the bar is set at the fully injected, airbrushed, wrinkle-free, then none of us, especially in this big media age, are free of it because those images are all around us. We're talking tonight about the most popular cosmetic medical procedure in the country, Botox. You go in, 10 minutes, your face is injected with poison, the wrinkles disappear into paralysis, and off you go, another thoroughly modern American. Have you had the Botox injection? Are you now Botox smooth and wrinkle-free? What's driving Americans to Botox away their wrinkles? Do we long for youth, fear aging, or need to look young to keep the job, the lover, the image? Talk to us tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the latest American obsession with looking good, with looking young. It comes out of a syringe, a poison injected in the face that paralyzes those pesky muscles that make wrinkles, and the wrinkles for a few months disappear. It's called Botox. Did you think you'd ever ask a doctor to inject your face with a deadly toxin? And if your friends have taken the Botox plunge, do you feel the need, the compulsion to do it too? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Dr. Jeffrey Dover. He's a professor of dermatology at Dartmouth Medical School and director of skin care physicians in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Jeffrey Dover, you have written, quoting from the greats, wrinkles are the imprints of exploits, applauding wrinkles, or Anna Magnin, who said to all of us, "Don't erase my wrinkles. They took me so long to earn." When you've got the syringe over that woman's face and you're taking out that brow furrow, do you ever think to yourself, you know, this really is a kind of a mark of pride. This is something that earned by life experience. I wonder why she doesn't just keep the wrinkle.
Often. I often have those thoughts. And in fact, we discuss these with patients before we ever do any of these cosmetic procedures. And it's interesting to hear some of the stories. But many women, for example, will say, look, I like the lines around my eyes. They give me character.
Mm-hmm.
But people always ask me why I look angry. Mm-hmm. And it's because of this line in between my eyes. Please get rid of it. And so they do have selective likes and dislikes. Certain wrinkles they like, certain ones they just don't.
5 days later, she won't be able to look angry or not easily when the Botox takes hold. Dr. Nancy Itkoff at Harvard Medical School is quoted as saying, it's as though we've given up on authenticity. On the other hand, who's in a hurry to be wrinkled? We're joined now by Jacqueline Jackson. She's executive producer of the Body Project documentary. She's a social worker. She's done extensive research on women and body image. Welcome back to the show, Jacqueline Jackson.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. We're talking about Botox tonight and its soaring popularity in metropolitan areas around the United States and the impending FDA approval of it as a cosmetic procedure that will then unleash a marketing tidal wave and we're told make it a household name all over the country. You've thought a lot about women and girls and body image and perception. Is this a way for women to feel better about themselves, or is this another brick in the wall of walking away from ourselves?
I think it's very much the brick in the wall thing. It's actually very frightening to me to think about it. The Body Project actually is looking at sort of the 100-year history of the female body in this country, mm-hmm. and the ways in which we have shifted dramatically from, a woman is good because of who she is on the inside, her character, you know, her humor, her moral character, to what she looks like on the outside. And just listening in on this, I have this sense of all the celluloid images we deal with every day in the media. We're surrounded by them crawling out of the screen and literally onto our faces, you know, kind of mask-like and an Escher-like sense of frightening to me, I think, and pretty dangerous to the female body and psyche.
Well, just how dangerous? I mean, in very technical terms, we're assured by our guest Jeffrey Dover that, that as long as the dosage and application is correct and according to procedure, there should be no or little physical risk with Botox. So where do you see the danger, Jacqueline Jackson?
I think the danger comes into, images of self-esteem. I'm curious about the depression and anger that's represented in that line between the eyes they're trying to erase, and you can't really erase it. I think it's a really dangerous thing for older women, the messages they're sending to younger girls. We talk so much about, you know, the young girls in our culture and how dangerous it can be and how toxic, and yet they learn more from watching what happens than from the words they hear. And this is a really, it's a really dangerous thing, saying it, what you look like is more important. It's going to be like that even when you're in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, so you better pay attention.
Is it necessarily a trade-off, Jacqueline Jackson? I mean, is it possible for someone to be both a wonderful person and also care what they look like? Is it an either-or both and?
I think it's both and, but I think, you know, you get into the whole mind-body split. I'm not split off from my body. I am my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that split can be so deep and so dangerous. And, I think almost in terms of evolutionarily, you look at most women in this country don't know their appetites. They don't know when they're hungry. They don't know when they're tired. They don't know when they want sex. I mean, just as human animals, we are getting so split off from the very humanness that is us.
You mean because of drugs, because of interventions of one kind or another?
And I think because of this incredible emphasis on external. We're out of touch with the cues of our internal in a lot of ways. And the cues that say, hey, I'm hungry, eat something. You know, eating disorders and appetite disorders are rampant. Just the whole body fever in this country, it's terrible, and it plays out on human health, and it's a public health issue and how it comes out to the human body.
Jeffrey Dover, you've written eloquently about changing notions of beauty and changing attitudes toward the idea of intervention to enhance beauty, saying that at one time it was considered actually against divine will. What's the notion been?
Look way back in time. Beauty was important back in the time of cavemen. When the caveman went out to kill dinner, the woman or spouse had to choose a partner who actually looked strong, was strong, was fleet of foot, who could actually go out, get dinner, and bring it back to them. And so we've actually, I think, been programmed in our genes through evolution for millions of years to actually be attracted to, quotes, beautiful things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it used to be that being really strong and really fast, really muscular, was very important for men. Henry Kissinger pointed out that power is the greatest aphrodisiac of all, and here's not the most beautiful man in the world, but very powerful, and his mind was his power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think over time what's happened is we've changed a bit, but the beautiful image is still an important one, and today it can be modified a bit, and we can do things to make ourselves look a certain way.
Please do, Jackie Jackson.
You crawl back into those Paleolithic caves, and the pictures you're going to see scrawled on there, the female pictures are of big-bellied women, big-breasted women. They were celebrations of birth, of nurturing, of death, of the natural human processes. And fast forward to today, and you've got the mask-like, externalized, anything human's pretty much cut off. It's not real. Those aren't real images. So I think that we've lost the power and beauty of image, and you know, they are important to the human psyche and soul, and they now are just so segregated from human psyche and soul, and in some ways drawing us out from them and making masks of these faces. We don't celebrate fecundity, birth, nursing, you know, the incredible miracle of this human body are not celebrated in our images today. And it's a huge loss, I think, to girls and women in particular.
Jackie Jackson, you're celebrating the Earth Mother, and there's something else going on at the same time, but both powerful, but the new thing may be more magnified by the media and clearly widely sought after. Jeffrey Dover, Jackie Jackson, stand by. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Valerie is on the line. Welcome, Valerie. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure. Valerie, what do you know about Botox?
Well, I was just saying that I've had it twice in the last, let's see, year, and I had it probably about two times a year for the past 2 years. My sister's had it.
How do you like it? Does it work for you, Valerie?
Very pleased with it. And I also don't feel like I have a frozen face, obviously, because my doctor uses it very sparingly. And so, therefore, yes, I can frown, but I don't have these terrible, tired lines in the middle of my head anymore.
Is that where you had it, just between your eyebrows, Valerie?
Yeah, exactly.
And can you see it gradually diminish over the months after the injection?
Yes, you tend to see the muscles start to pick up again, and you do look tired again in that sort of way. And that's why I've continued to use it, and I feel like I've really gotten a good result with it. And it definitely makes me feel better about how I look.
How have your friends and family and strangers even responded? Can you tell?
Well, my sister liked it so well, she went and got some for herself.
And I don't know if you heard our guest, Jacqueline Jackson, but
yes,
she's concerned about the impact of this pursuit of perfect beauty, that it's pulling women, all humans, away from a richer understanding of how we ought to look. What do you think about that, Valerie?
Well, I think that she has a point. And I appreciate her point, but I also think that when I look better, I feel better about myself, and that is important to me, to look and feel, to look better, and then I feel better. And so I understand that the culture is a beauty-based culture, but that's also the world that we are a part of, and I have embraced that.
Are you still able to look angry when you want to, Valerie?
Oh, yeah.
You're not that paralyzed.
Oh, no. Just ask my boyfriend. He knows.
Okay. Valerie, thanks very much for your call. Jeff Dover, is this a common response to Botox treatment?
Valerie makes a very important point, which is she does this in moderation. She can still frown and look angry, but she just looks a bit more rested and looks happier while the Botox is in place. And I think what Jacqueline says is very important and true, but we're talking about in moderation. We're not talking about freezing faces so they cannot frown, cannot smile. We're talking about used properly by artists, physicians who also have artistic ability to make the face look pleasing as the patient would wish, but we're not making mask-like faces.
Well, Jacqueline Jackson, what about that? Is this fundamentally different from, to go with Jeffrey Dover's image, maybe the cave woman who used some, you know, ashes to highlight her eyebrows or something? Is this just a kind of a cosmetic touch-up, that the kind of thing women have been doing for thousands of years?
Well, I think the probably average age of that cave woman was closer to 30.
An issue, maybe.
But I don't think they lived quite as long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wonder, like, how long do you keep doing that? Do you, until you're 80?
Yeah.
When do you stop, and when do you admit, I'm getting older, I'm going to die, and just sort of go with some more of a natural process, if you will.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, if it represents a denial of aging, Is there some kind of are we short-circuiting a philosophical journey that humans need to make through life to understand where they are? The New York Times quotes doctors saying they can't even tell anymore how old their patients are. If they're 50 or 70, that's maybe someone thinks that's something to celebrate. But do people get lost, Jeffrey Dover, in this world of cosmetic surgery and no longer in touch with where they are in the unavoidable arc of life?
Before I did the research into this paper on beauty we wrote, I was actually worried that we were sort of like Rome when it was about to burn, everybody running for cosmetic surgery and sort of forgetting their roots, mm-hmm. forgetting aging naturally, and sort of focusing on more important things in life. But the more I've read and written about this and the more patients I've seen, we meet patients like Valerie who aren't unhappy with themselves, but they have one feature which they don't care for.
Mm-hmm.
And if it can be fixed or improved, even just a little bit, it makes them happier people. I don't think Valerie's depressed. I don't think she's crazed about this cosmetic surgery. She just wants to look a little bit better.
Well, it's one feature, but I think Jacqueline Jackson sees it as a whole continuum that add up to a body image that may be out of touch with.
Yes, and I think for some people it is, and we see people with a condition called dysmorphophobia, where they have no concept of how they really look. But that's a very small segment of the population.
Dysmorphophobia. What a disembodied idea.
Right?
Well, a wonderful world, but a kind of a frightening
word.
Concept. Joanna is on the line. Welcome, Joanna. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was really glad that Dr. Dover made the comment that Botox is from botulism. It is the botulism toxin,
mm-hmm.
and as such, it can have a lot of, it could potentially have a lot of side effects.
Have you seen that, Joanna?
I am a physician, and I don't know the case, but I know of one person who was having Botox injections who was a healthy person,
mm-hmm.
and who every few months noticed that she was having some trouble with her breathing. And it took a long time till someone figured out that it corresponded with when she was getting her injections and that the Botox was probably getting absorbed systemically, and so it was affecting her muscles of breathing.
So it's some kind of allergic reaction in her case.
No, it's what the toxin does. It paralyzes the muscle. So in her case, it got absorbed systemically into her bloodstream, and it affected her muscles of breathing, not to the point of paralyzing her.
I see.
But enough to cause her to have some trouble breathing because she couldn't use her muscles adequately.
Well, that would give someone pause. Jeffrey Dover, have you seen, is this a common syndrome? Or does it, this is, if you really had botulism, that is the effect that paralyzes the respiratory system.
Right. Joanna makes a very important point, which is this is a toxin. And when the dose is injected, there is a very temporary effect on other muscles in the body, but it usually only lasts minutes, and most patients do not notice it. Obviously, in this case, this patient was sensitive to the Botox and should never get it again. But this is extraordinarily rare, and most patients never, ever have symptoms of the effect elsewhere other than in the muscles where it's injected.
Joanna, where do you come down on the pro or anti-Botox line here?
I'm not really sure, since it's something I've toyed with myself, since I have one of those wonderful frown lines.
There you go. It's catching.
But I have to say that my fear is now, if it's going to be advertised publicly, and that there's going to be a lot of people injecting it who probably don't have adequate training, and you're going to see accidents happen.
Mm-hmm.
Not on purpose. But I'm just afraid we're going to see that in the future, because you'll have a lot of inexperienced and not well-trained people using it. And I'll take the rest of the comments off the air. Thanks.
Joanna, thank you very much for your call. Jacqueline Jackson, the New York Times is calling this the next blockbuster drug. You can hear, here's the doctor who knows about the patient who has trouble breathing, but the doctor's done it for herself. Is there any stopping these things in a media age, once the images get out there, once the stars all look wrinkle-free? Where are the brakes on this train?
I think we need to create the brakes. I think it is a huge train, and it's massive to turn around. And I think one of the main ways is to try to understand better the ways in which all these pictures influence us. I think it's profound in terms of all the media images in our culture today. We don't really understand physiologically how the human body ingests them, but I think they do ingest them, and it translates not real healthily in a lot of ways.
The FDA has just signed on. Jeffrey Dover, how does American usage of Botox compare with use in Europe, Latin America, elsewhere in the world? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, Tom, I don't have a lot of information about that, except that it is extremely popular here, and it's only going to get more popular as the information about it gets out there.
And will this always have to be done in a doctor's office? This isn't kind of a tattoo parlor procedure.
Well, I'm glad you raised that issue. As a dermatologist, I'm very concerned that in New York City, for example, there is a clinic that's run and staffed by no physicians, only nurses and technicians, and they actually do Botox injections unsupervised. We as a society are trying to actually stop that from happening, because this is a toxin. It's a medical procedure and should be done by physicians. And Joanna, a physician who called in, made a very good point, which is that as more and more physicians do this, we will get physicians who do not have skill in skin surgery doing Botox, and they will end up with results which are not optimal. And so as more and more physicians do it and more patients do it, we will end up with some results that just aren't very nice.
What are the ways in which it can go wrong?
Well, if you inject just into the wrong place, just off by a millimeter, you can end up with a eyelid that drops, or you can end up with blurred vision, or the brow can drop, or the face can look asymmetrical, where one brow is lower and one brow is higher. The good news is it only lasts 3 or 4 months, and these can be corrected, but only usually by an expert. And so it's like any medical procedure. You want to be sure, if you're going to do it, to see an expert, a dermatologist or a plastic surgeon, and not an emergency room physician, for example, or a psychiatrist who's moonlighting to make a little bit of extra money doing cosmetic surgery.
How often does it go wrong in the hands of a professional?
Oh, about maybe 1 in 100. There's a slight asymmetry or a slight brow droop, but it can be then corrected with another injection. So it's not very common.
Mm. We're talking about the new face of America, very often the Botox face. Have you had the injection? Are you now Botox smooth and wrinkle-free? Is the Botox boom a sign of age denial, of cultural shallowness, or just a way to take a walk on the young side? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the booming use of Botox, the lethal, well, I should say poisonous injection that paralyzes muscles in the face to smooth away wrinkles. Administered correctly, it is not supposed to be unhealthy. The FDA is about to give it its formal stamp of approval as a cosmetic treatment. It is the most explosively booming drug in America. The market makers are saying it's the next blockbuster drug. But is this the way we want to treat our faces, injecting them with Botox? Have you had the injection? Are you now Botox smooth? And if you've had Botox injections, do you admit it in public? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Dover. He's director of the Skin Care Physicians of Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, and by Jacqueline Jackson, executive producer of the Body Project documentary, which is keeping tabs on how women think about their bodies. Jacqueline Jackson, Dr. Dover points out that this is not a cheap procedure. It's at least $300 probably per treatment, and you've got to do it 3 or 4 times a year if you want to keep on top of your Botox regime. Is this going to be the new kind of economic divide in America? If you're 45 and affluent, you'll be smooth-faced, and if you're 45 and not, you'll be wrinkled?
I think there is a pretty deep divide there, and I think the point made earlier, the fact that this is done by highly trained physicians, but it is America, so we'll end up having it done not quite by people as highly trained, and I would imagine problems with it will continue to grow that way, sort of the rip-off version of the Paris design, if you will. I would anticipate that would happen. And so the dangers to those who have less money to pay for a different kind of procedure, it's probably going to even be more damaging.
Not to mention, as the New York Times points out, you may not exactly know the face of the person that you've just met or that you may have just married. They quote a doctor saying you could marry a woman with a flawlessly even face and wind up with someone who 4 months later looks like a Shar Pei, if you know that very wrinkled Chinese dog. Nicole is on the line. Welcome, Nicole. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm 25,
okay.
So I'm young,
okay.
And I see a lot of women who are older than me trying to look young, and I think...
What do you think about it?
Oh, well, this is what I think. You know, they try so hard, they dye their hair, they get injections, they get surgery, and not only would I never mistake them for one of my peers, they actually end up looking older than they are.
Because they're not going with the flow, Nicole.
I'm thinking about two women I know in particular who are both in their late 30s, which is, you know, pretty young, but getting towards middle age. And one just kind of goes with it, and she's got a few gray hairs, whatever. She looks like a nice 30-something-year-old
mm-hmm.
lady.
Mm-hmm.
And one works out, dyes her hair, straightens her hair, gets boob jobs, gets all jobs.
The works.
And she looks like she's about 50. And she tries to pass herself as a 20-something-year-old, and it's like, no.
It just doesn't work in your eyes. Let me put
Maybe
that to...
Maybe people her age think that she looks younger.
Yeah.
Someone my age would never mistake her for a 20-something-year-old.
Jeffrey Dover, is there a... And Nicole, thanks for your call. Is there a sliding scale here? Do people's expectations change as they age about what they need from it? And is there such a thing as trying too hard?
Yes to all of that. Nicole, keep in mind that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And it would be interesting to know what that blonde, bleached, boob-jobbed woman thinks about how she looks. But I think it's very important to point out that there are procedures being done that don't make people look younger. They just make them look worse. And so the tight facelift or the extra large breast or extra liposuction. What's being developed in dermatology over the last 10 and 15 years are new technologies that make very subtle changes and make people look gently a bit younger without a lot of pulling, without a lot of tightening, with no downtime. And so as these new procedures evolve, Nicole, you'll see 35-year-olds who look like great 35-year-olds. That's what they should be looking at. They should not try to look 25. But it can be a problem, and I think Nicole's probably hit something that's really important.
Jeffrey Dover, you've got a very soothing line for the women who come into your clinic. I'm sure they go for it. Maggie's on the line. Welcome, Maggie. You're on the air.
Thank you. I told your person that, answers the phone.
Yes.
I recently met a very nice man, and we've become very close friends.
That's terrific.
It is. He wrote me, a nice letter that said about, and I can't remember just how that started.
Mm-hmm.
You have a marvelous face. He said, I love your wrinkles, the way they move, even flow across your face when you smile or laugh. And I am 73 and he is 75.
Well, and you're not going for the Botox thing, Maggie.
No.
You've got a man who likes your wrinkles just the way they are.
Not now, anyway.
Well, Maggie, when you see your wrinkles, what do they say to you? What do they show? What do they say to you about your life, about yourself?
Well,
here's a man who loves them. How do they look to you?
Well, they look better since he said that.
I'm sure that's the truth.
They don't bother me too much.
Yeah.
They don't bother me too much. But I did have very deep furrows, frown lines.
Yes.
And one time when I had cut my nose and that was needing to be sewed up, I had them. This is probably 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I had them do something surgical that somewhat reduced the depth of those furrows, and I thought I was happy to do that because I thought they made me look cross and disagreeable.
So sounds, Maggie, like you've had it both ways, taking care of that furrow, but also had the man who loves your wrinkles when you're 73. Congratulations on pulling that off. Thanks for calling.
You're most welcome.
Let's go to line 5, where Andrew is on the line. if we can turn there. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Recently, actually, my wife had pointed out to me that I have that vertical crease between my eyes.
All right. Are you looking angry all the time?
Well, I don't know if it was anger, but it was certainly a stress response.
Yes.
I'd be thinking about something, a little stressed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that when I do relax, those lines go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I can actually feel a very pleasant sensation in my forehead of relaxation after, just doing some stretching or just hanging loose for a bit.
And it doesn't take a neurotoxin injection to get it.
No, and it also, I think, challenges me to sort of deal with how I cope with stress and how I react to things. So it's sort of like a little signal for me that I found very helpful to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, thank you very much for that observation. I mean, that really gets to it in a way, doesn't it? Jacqueline Jackson, wouldn't it be nice if we could deal with these stress lines by dealing with the stress, not just wallpapering them over?
I think that's very true, and I think it's the quick fix mentality in this country that really is dangerous, because you are masking, you know, all the human feelings, stress, everything in there that probably needs to be dealt with in a perhaps longer term way, but really getting to the issue rather than just covering it up. And I think the point earlier that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I don't even know if that's that true anymore. I think beauty is so narrowly defined and so youngly defined in our culture that that's the danger. The beholder doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter that much anymore. There's not a wide range of definitions. It's very narrow.
Beauty's in the eye of the cover of Cosmo or Vogue.
Exactly. And we see it every day, constantly, images all around us, and it's very young and it's very thin. And it's, you know, it's not like what the majority of people look like.
Wow. Jeffrey Dover, we just have 20 seconds left, but what's the future here? This is a new technology that's come on in the last decade. Is there more to come technologically?
There's lots more. Lasers have actually led the way to help people to look their best with very simple procedures, with no downtime. I think the most important thing is if people want to stay looking young, stay out of the sun, and take good care of their skin, they won't need any of these procedures as they age gracefully.
Mm. Jeffrey Dover is professor of dermatology at Dartmouth Medical School and director of skin care physicians of Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Jacqueline Jackson, executive producer of The Body Project, thank you very much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Well, there you are. To Botox or not to Botox, everybody will make their own decision. For ongoing coverage of the day's events, which may give you stress lines or may not, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Back in September, the release of an action movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as a fireman taking on Colombian terrorists was held back because the movie company thought American audiences were still too sensitive after the attacks of September 11th. Now, that studio is betting that the country's ready for a pop thrill, popcorn flick about terrorism as their film Collateral Damage opens tonight. In September, we asked, when will we all laugh again? Now, the late-night comedians thrive on jokes about the war on terror. Will Gluck is a television and Hollywood screenwriter living in Hollywood. In this radio diary, he talks about how getting back to normal, in Hollywood terms, worked on its own peculiar timeline.
Last year, I worked on a television show that took place at a bomb factory. That wasn't the main focus of the comedy. It could have been set anywhere, but it just happened to be set at a company that made nuclear bombs, cruise missiles, pretty much anything that exploded. Then September 11th came. That's what people are saying these days, September 11th came. Like it was the mail or rain or the cable guy. I was sure we were going to have to change the setting or at the very least take the recovering alcoholic approach and not talk about the elephant sitting on the couch. In the days of a nation challenged, America on alert, and five-a-day funerals, who would want to watch a comedy about things blowing up? On September 12th, no one, especially not me. I came into work expecting a heavy day of rethinking, reconceiving, and rewriting among a heavy backdrop of grief, anger, and disbelief. Disbelief is right. Because we didn't change a thing. Not the bomb factory, not the jokes about the bombs, nothing. Everyone else assured me that by the time the show aired, 4 months from then, America would find these things funny again. Comedy, after all, is tragedy plus time, right? Yeah, but who decides the timetable? Why would this be spoofable, but the Crusades and the London Blitz still taboo? When are we going to get the all clear to laugh about the Rwandan genocide or Columbine? I've got some great material on breast cancer I've been waiting to bust out. I made it clear to my coworkers that I thought they were seriously underestimating the impact September 11th was going to have on the American psyche. Thankfully, we had to go home before any work could be done because of a credible threat the FBI received against all Hollywood studios. As the line of BMW, Mercedes, and Lexus SUVs jockeyed to escape the supposedly high-profile hotspot, I looked at the murals of that studio's latest releases. Unless the terrorists were big Gary Busey direct-to-video fans, that was probably the safest place in the world to be right then. I drove home that day, sure that cooler heads at the studio would prevail and the show would inevitably be retooled. I wasn't crazy, right? The World Trade Centers were blown up, a plane crashed into the Pentagon. John Boom Boom Ashcroft was on TV every 2 seconds, telling us to be vigilant, whatever the hell that meant. I took it to mean using my turn signal as well as sticking my arm out the window. This was a different world, right? Nothing was funny anymore. It's now 5 months later, and I couldn't have been more wrong. Letterman does Al-Qaeda jokes in his monologue. Saturday Night Live constantly makes fun of Dick Cheney in his undisclosed location. And Jay Leno just did a sketch featuring Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, on Jeopardy. It wasn't particularly funny, but anything's better than watching Jay Leno circa September 20th trying to be our moral compass. An American flag pin on a guy reading wacky newspaper headlines does not a leader make. See, I'm even doing it, making fun of Jay Leno. 5 months after September 11th came, and everything's back to normal. And truth be told, it only took me a day or two after my "you're underestimating this" rant to sink back into the routine of sitting around a table writing jokes about people in a bomb factory. Sure, I would have liked a few months to digest and process what happened, but Hollywood doesn't have that luxury. We have to make a product now that won't be consumed until months from now, like a sardine cannery, without the industrial accidents. So this all begs the question, what kind of people can do this? How can we numb ourselves to the reality of the outside world and keep on keeping on? I'd like to think it's because we have no choice. It is a job, after all, and we're paid to do it, just like a truck driver is paid to drive through a snowstorm, or a teacher is paid to teach disruptive little brats. But the more I've thought about it, the more I think it's just our way of dealing with things. What's better therapy than talking openly about something so disturbing? Maybe in Hollywood, making fun of things forces us to confront issues head-on. Nothing remains unsaid, unchallenged, or unopened. For us, comedy equals tragedy. Time is for everybody else. There's also that tiny part of me that thinks we're just bad people without ethics or morals. Like the executive at a studio who burst into tears after hearing the FBI received a threat on the lives of all the senior executives and their families. She couldn't believe she didn't make the list. She was heard screaming down the halls, "What do I have to do around here to get my life threatened?"
Will Gluck lives in where else? Hollywood, California. Listeners, we want your story on our show. Radio Diaries start with an email or a letter from you. In just a moment, I'll give you the addresses, but first, some guidelines. Before we record them, these diaries start out as essays that are usually 600 to 800 words long, and the subjects can run the gamut. How has your life been affected by the war on terror, the Enron scandal, the flagging economy, Botox? What music have you found comfort in? What works of art have helped you to make sense of the world? How is your experience as a soldier, as a parent, an immigrant, an expatriate, a doctor, a cabbie, a teenager, coloring your interpretation of what you read in the paper or hear on the radio? Share your story with us. Now, the address. Send your essays and your ideas by email to onpoint@wbur.org or by mail, snail mail, to onpoint, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. That's On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.